Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're executing a mission that really, it sits right at the heart of European security. We're talking about Belarus. And the big question we need to answer is, well, it's simple on the surface, but the answer is incredibly complex. Is Minsk a sovereign entity, you know, trying to balance its position, or is it already just a Russian satellite?
And that's the tension, right? That's what makes this so critical. Our mission here is to unpack these really complex and often contradictory signals coming out of Minsk.
And also the different ways the West is responding.
Exactly. The different strategies from Washington and Brussels. And all the while, we have to keep a focus on the just incredible depth of integration, military and ideological, with Moscow since 2020.
The material here is so dense. I mean, we're covering everything from border closures and sanctions deals to nuclear rhetoric and helium balloons.
Right. It's a lot to get through.
It is a sprawling set of documents. So, okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with how the West is approaching this, because the sources are pretty clear that Washington and Brussels are not on the same page.
Not at all. What you see immediately is this emerging asymmetry. The European Union is looking at Belarus almost exclusively through the lens of hybrid threats.
Okay.
And they have a very hardened official stance. Absolutely no engagement until all political prisoners are freed. Period.
But Washington's approach seems much more pragmatic, almost transactional. How does the U.S. justify that when Brussels is so dug in?
Well, Washington sees Belarus as a potential model for, let's call it, calibrated engagement, something that can yield tangible, immediate results.
And for the U.S., the main goal is?
Securing prisoner releases. It's a clear humanitarian goal, but it also, you know, it keeps a line of communication open.
And have they had any success with that?
They've had some. Over 200 detainees have been freed. That includes all the prominent opposition figures from 2020, and importantly, the Nobel laureate Ales Bialyatsky.
And the incentive for Minsk to let these high-profile people go is just easing economic pressure, isn't it?
Precisely. It's a transactional exchange. After those big releases, the United States lifted sanctions on the state airline, Belavia.
Right.
And then the big one on Belarusian potash. Potash is one of the country's biggest exports. It's a vital revenue stream for the regime.
So even though there are still over 1,000 political prisoners, these specific high-profile gestures are driven by cash.
Exactly. It's a quid pro quo.
And beyond the humanitarian angle, the sources suggest Washington sees a kind of tactical utility here.
Absolutely. Belarus provides this discreet, though very difficult, channel for passing messages to Moscow.
On completely different topics.
Yeah, on things like Venezuela or just broader de-escalation measures. It's a testing ground for limited engagement, you know, while all the other channels are frozen solid.
But we have to mention the warnings here from the opposition leaders, Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya. She argues this whole strategy is flawed.
She does. I mean, she supports the humanitarian part, of course. But her warning is that Lukashenko is just trying to fool the U.S.
Oh, so
he sells this engagement to his own people as legitimization, as normalization, while he stays completely pro-Russian. Her point is that this just allows him to pay back his debts to Moscow for crushing the 2020 protests.
That idea that engagement is just legitimization, that takes us right to the border, where Europe has gone in the complete opposite direction from the U.S.
Right. They've chosen confrontation. It's become this cycle of escalation. We saw it really clearly with the Zapad 2025 military exercise.
Minsk actually tried to de-escalate that a bit, didn't they?
They did. They took visible steps. They relocated the drills away from the Polish border. They cut participation down to about 7,000 troops. And they even invited OSCE observers.
And yet Poland and Lithuania still used it as an excuse to close crossings.
Exactly. Warsaw completely closed its border right on the eve of the exercise, citing an incident with Russian drones in their airspace.
And Lithuania.
Vilnius closed its border just before a security conference in Minsk, citing a, well, a totally different threat. Helium balloons.
Helium balloons. I mean, it sounds absurd, but these closures had very real and very asymmetric effects.
Oh, absolutely. The Lithuanian move was so rigid, it stranded about 1,800 of their own trucks in Belarus. Immediate economic pain.
But Belarus was more pragmatic with Poland, I see here.
Notice the contrast. Yeah. When 1,500 Polish trucks got trapped, Belarus just extended their visas and permits. That shows you there are back channels, and also that China has a deep interest in keeping that transit route open.
Let's go back to the balloons, because the sources tie this to something much bigger, cross-border cigarette smuggling.
It's a massive, highly profitable operation. We're talking about elite business interests in Minsk linked with criminal networks in the EU.
And the numbers are huge.
Huge. 966 balloon incidents in 2024, another 544 in 2025. And this was the workaround after drones, which smugglers used before, were criminalized. The balloons ended up disrupting Vilnius airport over 10 times.
So Vilnius sees this purely as a hybrid attack, a deliberate disruption by the state.
Right. While Minsk publicly says, oh, this is just criminal opportunism that Lithuania is politicizing. But here's the kicker.
What's that?
Belarusian insiders admit the trade is tolerated. Why? Because it funnels off-budget money to networks close to the presidency. It's what analysts call instrumentalized smuggling.
Okay, so this whole cycle just reinforces the EU's position. Every incident is hybrid warfare, and the door stays shut.
It does. But it's important to see the divergence. Poland is maintaining some of those working channels, even talking about reopening crossings. Lithuania, on the other hand, is committed to total isolation.
But that have to be costing them.
It is. The economic costs, especially losing the potash transit business after the U.S. eased sanctions, is creating a lot of internal debate in Vilnius. You have to wonder how long they can afford that kind of purity.
Well, whether they can afford it or not, the military reality seems to make the whole debate kind of moot. Since 2022, Belarus has gone from being an ally to a full-on Russian armed outpost.
The change is stark. And it's probably irreversible in the short term. Belarus was the launchpad for the 2022 invasion. Airfields, railways, integrated air defense, fuel, everything.
And the numbers are just staggering.
Over 700 missiles were launched from Belarusian territory into Ukraine between February 2022 and March 2023 alone.
And this military relationship, it's not just logistical, it became deeply industrial.
Exactly. Belarusian firms are now critical nodes in the Russian military-industrial complex. We're not talking small parts. Companies like Integral and Legmash are repairing Russian tanks, modernizing aircraft.
Wait, I see something here about microchips for cruise missiles.
That's right. They're supplying critical components, including those microchips. One report said at least 287 state enterprises are involved in producing weapons or components for Russia. This isn't just cooperation, it's total supply chain integration.
Which means if you want to effectively sanction Russia's war machine, you have to treat the Belarusian industrial base as part of it.
You have to. And this is all cemented by the nuclear sharing arrangement.
Let's talk about that nuclear shadow. This is probably the single most consequential move in this whole story.
It started with Lukashenko offering to host Russian nukes back in 2022. Then the 2023 constitutional referendum officially ended Belarus's nuclear-free status.
And Russia followed through.
They delivered. Nuclear-capable Iskander-M missile systems, modified Su-25 jets to carry nuclear weapons, and they've slated the Oreshnik system for deployment by the end of the year.
And the Oreshnik is significant. It's a newer, possibly hypersonic system.
Yeah.
This adds a whole new strategic layer. And Russia actually changed its doctrine to back this up, correct?
They did. Russia revised its policy to allow for using nuclear weapons if there's aggression against Belarus that creates a, quote, critical threat to sovereignty. It officially binds Belarus's nuclear fate to Moscow.
So with all that in place, the rhetoric around the Zapad 25 exercise was incredibly aggressive, but the actual exercise was less so. What explains that disconnect?
Well, initially, officials like the defense minister, Krannon, they were leveraging the nuclear rhetoric, talking about planning for the actual use of tactical nukes.
But that's not what happened.
No. The exercise itself was much smaller and mostly conventional, and the imagery was very telling.
And how so?
The photos of the nuclear-capable Iskander system showed them with conventional training warheads. You could see a white stripe on them. This broke from the past, where they would just blur the warheads to imply they were live nuclear forces.
So that's Lukashenko's balancing act.
It's his balancing act. He needs Russia's nuclear protection, but he also wants to project this image of being a responsible, independent state. But at the end of the day, his autonomy is a fiction. Belarus is absorbed into Russia's nuclear posture.
And that dependency is mirrored perfectly in the economy. The sources call it an economic takeover disguised as recovery.
That's a perfect way to put it. After 2020, Lukashenko endorsed these 28 union state programs. They sound bureaucratic, but they're harmonizing everything. Legal systems, markets, energy, tax.
The unified tax system alone seems huge. It gives Moscow access to all taxpayer data.
It does. And the market lock-in is just profound. 70% of Belarus's exports go directly to Russia.
70%.
And when you add in transit through Russian channels, Moscow controls over 90% of all of Belarus's outbound trade. That's not a partnership. That's an economic hostage situation.
Plus the debt.
Right. Belarus owes about $8 billion in loans to Russia. It's Moscow's largest debtor. Its fiscal survival depends entirely on Russian support.
What about the IT sector? That used to be a real bright spot for them.
It's been devastated. IT exports have plummeted by 45%, dropped from $3.2 billion in 2021 to $1.8 billion in 2023. Over 19,000 workers have left.
And I assume Russian firms moved in.
Systematically. As Western companies fled, Russian investors moved in, tying the whole sector to Russia's isolated digital ecosystem. It's a strategic dead end.
So the grip tightens economically, militarily, and now culturally. Moscow is trying to redefine what it means to be Belarusian.
That process is speeding up. A new union state media holding is launching in 2025, headquartered in Moscow. It's a huge step toward full media integration under the Kremlin.
And the schools.
Mandatory courses on state ideology, mandatory military training, and the clearest sign of all is the language.
It's declining.
Fewer than 1 in 10 students study the Belarusian language today. You have to compare that to 1999,
right,
when 86% of citizens called it their native tongue. It's a slow-motion cultural annexation.
This brings us to the core of it, ideology. Both regimes use it as a tool, but the sources point out some really crucial differences.
The similarities are, you know, on the surface. Both use it to retain power. They share anti-Western rhetoric, traditional values, the cult of the great patriotic war, all that.
But the actual nature of the ideologies is different.
Fundamentally different. Russian ideology, Putinism, is aggressive. It's imperial. It glorifies the state. It's driven by revenge, this idea that torn territories must return. It openly justifies war.
Whereas the Belarusian version is defensive.
Entirely defensive. It's focused solely on the self-preservation of the regime. The main idea is the cult of stability at any cost. Its whole emotional appeal is, as long as it does not become worse at home, it urges people not to rock the boat.
And it all comes down to one person.
It lacks any real national idea. It just reduces everything to Lukashenko himself. The ideology is Belarus's Lukashenko.
But despite those differences, since 2020, the convergence seems total.
It is. The regime is fully dependent on Moscow now, so Belarusian propaganda just relays Kremlin narratives. Decaying Europe, anti-Polish rhetoric. Lukashenko has become a junior partner in the imperial project.
And this picture of total absorption clashes so sharply with what the polling data says Belarusians actually want.
The gap is huge, and it's important. Over 85% of Belarusians oppose sending troops to Ukraine. More than half disapprove of the missile attacks from their soil.
And what about the nuclear weapons?
Two-thirds of the population oppose having Russian nuclear weapons on their territory.
So they aren't resigned to just being a Russian proxy?
Not at all. Half might back an alliance with Russia, but 57% also believe Belarus should improve ties with the EU. And crucially, very few want a single state with Russia. It suggests this quiet, persistent resistance.
So given this contradictory reality, what should the West actually do? What do the analysts recommend?
The consensus is that the West has to elevate the issue. Treat Belarus as a national security priority right alongside Ukraine and the Baltics. And that means synchronizing pressure.
How better sanctions?
Expand and enforce sanctions against Minsk's military-industrial complex. And target the evasion hubs, like the UAE, to really raise the cost.
And on the inside, focus on building resilience.
Yes. Support independent media, support educational platforms, create an alternative space for thought and culture. And finally, contingency planning is essential.
Preparing for a post-Lukashenko world.
Exactly. Prepare for internal collapse and offer clear public guarantees of support, economic aid, security cooperation to give elites an incentive to defect.
It's a sobering picture. The absorption is military, economic, and cultural. But that flicker of hope seems to be rooted in the people and the regime's own limited vision.
That's the core paradox we started with. Belarus is absorbed, but the population and even the regime's own defensive ideology, well, they limit full compliance with Moscow's aggressive imperial project.
The old Balki doctrine, Belarus as a buffer, is narrowing fast, but maybe it's not fully closed yet. It seems the future will depend less on Minsk's intentions and more on whether the EU can finally adopt a strategic rather than just a symbolic approach.
And this leaves you with a really important question to think about. How long can a regime survive when its core ideological drive is purely defensive, just survival at home? But its military and economic strategy is entirely expansive, serving Moscow's imperial goals. That tension, you have to think, cannot hold forever.